From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. When you think of mafia music, is this what comes to mind? Well, there's a lot more to mob music than the love theme from The Godfather. There's also Il Canto di Malavita, Songs of a Bad Life. These are the songs of the Calabrian Mafia, songs with graphic lyrics full of blood, murder, and vengeance, and songs that promote a sense of belonging.
It explained that there is nothing more important than the society, and that he is ready to die for it, to suffer and die for it.
Today we continue our four-part series on music. In this second part, we ask the musical question, how does society shape music and music makers? We'll also look at how music makers shape society. For example, Janis Joplin.
Oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz? My friends all drive Porsche. I must make amends. Worked hard all my lifetime, no help from my friends. So, oh Lord, won't you buy me a Mercedes-Benz?
First, if you're lucky enough to get tickets to the Metropolitan Opera on the right night, you might catch one of its rising stars, bass Hao Zhengtian. His story's incredible. Tian grew up in China, in Beijing, during the Cultural Revolution. It was a time of total isolation when Mao Zedong purged the country of all Western influence and declared war on the arts. Western literature, art, and music were eradicated. But somehow during those days, Hao Zhengtian discovered a love of music that would carry him to America and ultimately to the stage of the Metropolitan Opera. The journey wasn't easy. Even before the revolution started, Tian hated practicing piano.
One morning, my mother told me, your piano teacher was put in jail. Oh, I said, okay, Mom, thanks. And so I went out. I was running and shouting to the air around the courtyard, you know, for three runs. I said, oh, I don't have to play piano anymore. Oh, I was, you know, just yelling. And I didn't realize, you know, he was in jail for 5 years. I didn't realize that was horrible, you know, that was so horrible for his life. After many years, I went back to Beijing. That was the first time I told him the story. I was so happy after he was put in jail. And we were all in tears. My father was a conductor. My mother is a composer. They were all trained Western music education in early 50s in China. So, yeah, I was born in a musical family. We had, I think, at least over 200 records, you know, those kind of a 78 speed, black, big, you know, records at home and all with Western music, Tchaikovsky, Beethoven, and Mozart, Bach. My father bought a Russian-made record player, just like a wood cabinet, you know, use a steel needle, you know, that kind of thing. You have the roll. When the Cultural Revolution started, I remember one day, I was probably 11 years old, my father asked me to bring all those records to the recycling station to sell it. My father actually was always pretty quiet, serious. So in front of him, I was always nervous. I can remember now, behind his serious face, you know, it's kind of bitter, because that's his treasure, you know? So I brought all those records to the recycling station, and they asked me to break those records to pieces because they don't collect whole records. You have to really break them to pieces. And so I used a little hammer, you know. I broke all those records to pieces, those over 200 records or so. My family was forced to leave Beijing to go to southern China. And we only got several days to prepare, you know, for leaving. So our apartment was a mess. When I was trying to, you know, help my father to pack this record player, I found two records behind the cabinet my father kept. One was Beethoven's Sixth. My father conducted it, I think it was in 1963. That was the last Western piece he conducted. So he kept, actually hide that record, you know, in the cabinet. So I told my father, I said, "Hi, Daddy, I found two records." I mean, well, he came to me and took the records from me and looked at it for probably a couple of seconds. And I said, let's play this record. And the music started. And that was really a first time I listened a Western symphonic work. And, you know, the melody is beautiful, but I was only 12 or some years old. So my father started to tell me about this piece. And he said that this is, you know, interlude, this is the theme of this piece, and the first movement. Now is, you know, you hear, here's the wind, the storm is coming, and I feel he was really talking to himself, you know. And I remember one thing clearly until today was his face. His face was so tender, so beautiful, let's use this word, okay? With a smile, with something shining, you know, in his eyes. If I say that was a musical lesson from my father, and that was the only one, the first one and the last one. Because 2 days later, my family left Beijing for 12 years. People heard lots of stories about the Cultural Revolution, you know, mostly tragedies, you know, about the Cultural Revolution, Red Guards, and they destroyed Chinese culture, and, you know, lots of intellectuals suffered, lost their lives, even, you know. To me, of course, you know, I went through lots of hardship and lots of difficulties during that 10 years. But also, I learned a lot. I have seen a lot. I saw this man jumped, you know, from the pagoda. It's about probably 12 floors high, and I knew he was dying. But I remember one thing clearly, his face was peaceful, with even a little smile, you know. I think he wanted to die, to leave. In China, especially close to the end of the Cultural Revolution, the pressure was so heavy. You just couldn't breathe. One day I was riding a bicycle to cross the city to look for a friend. So I didn't really go up, you know, fifth floor to knock on door. I was shouting. I was just calling my friend name outside of the building. "Hey, Steve, are you there? I'm Tia. I'm looking for you. Are you home?" My friend was not home, and another window opened, and a gentleman started talking to me, said, "Hey, who are you? Are you a singer?" I said, what are you talking about? He said, "Well, you got a big voice. Come up. So he was asking me to go to his apartment. So I went to his apartment for 5 minutes, and these 5 minutes changed my life. he was a professional singer. He asked me, you know, what I was doing, and you love singing, you love music, and you got a good voice. You should find a voice teacher to start, and you may have a good future, you know, with singing. So I started to find a voice teacher, and I started with him for 1 year, and the Cultural Revolution stopped, and the music school reopened to the public. So I applied. That was hard, very hard. But the first year, 1977, the Central Conservatory of Music in Beijing, they opened to the public again after these many years. And the first class, there was a limit of 17 voice students from all over China. In Beijing, there was only one opening, and 500 applicants applied to fight for this one opening. I got it. Well, in the contest, in 1976, I did this song, The Beauty of Beijing, or something like that. It's kind of a revolutionary song based on Tibetan folk tune. The test is there are thousands of beautiful horses, but there's only one, you know, most beautiful. And there was thousands of flowers, but only one flower is, you know, the best. And there are millions of songs, but only one song is, you know, we should bring with. And we should ride the most beautiful horse and holding this, you know, beautiful flower and singing this most beautiful song and to Beijing, to Chairman Mao. You know, that's a test. And the tune is like a 草原上马儿千万匹，千呀千万匹，醉君的又一匹，醉君的又一匹。
Today, Hao Zhengtian is developing two operas about Chinese history. He also sings regularly at the Metropolitan Opera. Coming up, composer Golan Levin talks about a new use for cell phones that will have Beethoven turning over in his grave.
Since everyone has one and they are capable of making musical tones, the idea of like saying, well, what are the musical possibilities of these kinds of things? Not just to hear a single tone, but to hear an ensemble of them was what sort of inspired the idea.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. I've been to concerts where someone's cell phone has started ringing, ruining the music I'd been enjoying up until that point. So imagine if you were in an auditorium and 200 cell phones were ringing incessantly. You might call it a music lover's worst nightmare. Not Golan Levin. He'd call it dial tones, a telesymphony. In fact, that's what he did call it. Levin created this musical work for 200 cell phones. He explained the inspiration for his telesymphony.
I was at a concert in Europe, and the MC didn't know English all that well, and he by accident said, could everyone please leave their cell phones on? And I thought that was kind of funny, and I kind of began to speculate, well, what would that be like? And then to actually say, well, could one, in some sense, compose the ringtones of these things? And that's sort of where the idea began. I couldn't imagine something more challenging at the time than trying to get several hundred phones ringing in unison.
And it is kind of an amazing thought to think about it. I mean, what irritates us all about it is that they're so unexpected, even though I suppose in some ways we've come to expect that some joker in the audience is going to forget.
Once, you know, I had this initial concept, the idea really kind of gelled when I began to perceive exactly this kind of love-hate relationship that people have with these phones. Everyone has one, which would suggest that we love them, and yet at the same time, it's a real social faux pas if it rings. And, you know, people turn up their nose at hearing these things. They really invade our lives, our public lives, our private lives. Nothing's worse than a business call in an intimate moment, and nothing's worse than an intimate call at a business moment. And this constantly happens. And so anytime there's a love-hate relationship like this where there's this kind of deep ambivalence about a topic, I think that's a very fertile territory for art to be located in. And there is a large 20th century tradition of music, let's say, that focuses on the aesthetic possibilities of a given system, whatever that might be. In the 20th century, it was, you know, exploring what are the musical possibilities, let's say, of the automobile. And so you have like Laurie Anderson in 1972 taking, you know, hundreds of car horns, arranging for all these automobiles to park in a certain location and then hitting their horns on cue. Or earlier in the century, you know, musicians working with work whistles and other kinds of devices that would ordinarily not be considered musical instruments. And so since everyone has one and they are capable of making musical tones, the idea of like saying, well, what are the musical possibilities of these kinds of things? Not just to hear a single tone, but to hear an ensemble of them was what sort of inspired the idea.
There is an element of amusement in our irritation. I mean, I was at a service once, and one of the guest speakers was in the middle of delivering a very serious presentation when her cell phone began to ring.
Mm-hmm. You know, and the ambivalence even goes to the point of the designers of the phones. I'm thinking right now in particular of Nokia phones, but many phones have something like this. If you look at the names of the preset ringtones on the new Nokia phones, they have names like Mosquito and Bee and you know, other kinds of insects. And these are things that, you know, bite us or sting us. And why we would want something like that in our pocket is kind of funny to me. And also the fact that these things are, the musical sounds that they make are very specifically designed to get our attention, right? I mean, they're not designed to sort of sit back in the ambience and kind of like, well, maybe you have a phone call. No, if you have a phone call, this piezoelectric speaker has been designed to let you know about that. And so it happens to hit, you know, that band of frequencies, which is most audible to the human ear, which is to say the most shrill set of frequencies you can imagine. So again, that was a kind of fun musical challenge, but it's precisely that, you know, to work with this material, which is deliberately annoying, deliberately attention-grabbing, and to try and tone it down and make it mild and maybe interesting.
One of the other things that I suppose becomes obvious is that you are dealing with people, some of whom might want to mess with the system, and others might just react because they're programmed to, in a way, by answering the phone, which would, of course, cut off the ring.
Yeah, that's true. The moment anyone answered the phone, their light was cut off, the sound ended and so forth. But you kind of touch on a very interesting topic that was something that was not part of the design of the project for me, but was a really interesting emergent result. And this was the psychological reactions of the audience to experiencing this concert. And it was something I could not have predicted until really it was over. The concert begins with a single person ringing. Their phone rings, and there's a kind of lighting system, which is video projection onto the audience from above, in which whoever's ringing has a spotlight on them, up to 60 of these kinds of spots of light for whoever is ringing.
Do you have a favorite part of the finished product?
I do, and I should explain a little bit of the structure of the concert. The way it works really is that there's three sections. There's about 8 minutes each, so the whole length is 26 minutes or so. The first section is just the orchestra, the 200 people in the audience and ringing in various ways. The second section is actually a soloist, my colleague Scott Gibbons, who performs on 6 amplified but unmodified phones. And so there he's up on stage and he performs these phones and presses buttons on them in various ways. And the third movement is the soloist performing with the orchestra. And so you hear the audience together with Scott on his 6 phones. And my favorite part would be just at the end of his solo, as the orchestra comes in, and the orchestra comes in with these thin, pure drones that last a long time that sound a bit like bagpipes or maybe a pipe organ.
Golan Levin is the creator of Dial Tones, a telesymphony. Americans tend to think that the mafia is based in Sicily. And that's true of the Sicilian mafia. But there are other groups of mafia, like the Calabrian mafia, which is based in the southern tip of Italy. The Calabrian mafia is also known as 'Ndrangheta. It's a word of Greek origin, which means courage or loyalty. The 'Ndrangheta formed in the 1860s. When the Italian government banished a group of Sicilians. They relocated to Calabria and formed small criminal groups based on blood relationships and marriages. The Calabrian mafia has its own musical culture, Il Canto di Malavita, which means songs of a bad life. Francesco Sibano is an Italian journalist who's put together a compilation CD of Calabrian mafia music. Sibano told Steve Paulson that respect is a big part of Calabrian culture.
Respect for the tradition means to help people who needs it, who needs to be helped, without asking something back. You don't have to ask, for money. I have helped you and then I get your money. This is the mafia of today. This is not the tradition. So respect means to behave like this. You see a poor man on the street, with a real problem, and then you try to help him. At the moment, you are a man of respect, and you win honor if you give the people respect. So This is the concept of the values of respect and honor. They are normally real Calabrian values. They're not mafia values. It was the most important thing for the Calabrian people, respect and honor, and that's why the boss, took a lot of care to respect and honor, or let respect the rules of respect and honor. We say that every Calabrian is a man of respect, and the mafia just took the value of respect and made their own rules.
There's one song called The Traitors, and it starts off with, I have to say, some pretty strong lyrics. It goes something like, you are not a man, you are nothing, a carcass bloated by shame. You have betrayed the hearts of many. You are a spy and a traitor. You have lost the right to life.
Right.
Chi fini brutta fanno I confrenti? Chi di nascosto fanno I cantanti?
The lyrics were very hard because the result of what a traitor did, speak with the police about fact of respect and honor, the result was not only the person who may be a boss in jail, it was not only this, because the boss had to care about the whole village. The boss in jail, then there is no society anymore in the village. It was in the past like this. And the danger was not to put in jail only the boss, but to put in jail the boss and all the others. And what about the family, the mafia families? If you think about a village in Calabria, you have to think about the society of owner is composed from five persons, only five. And what's about the rest? I mean, if your son is a mafia member, you can't do nothing against it, but the people says you are a mafia member. So The problem is, if you betrayed a person who takes part of the society, you betrayed the whole society and the whole village. That's why the lyrics about traitors are so hard.
But I know many Italians, as well as Italian-Americans, have criticized this album because they say that it glorifies the mafia.
It doesn't glorify the mafia. We use it against the new mafia, even against the new mafia, because we say it has changed. In the past, we accept the history. What we don't accept is the violence.
I want to ask you about one more song from your album. The translation is Belonging to the Society. Can you tell me about this song?
It is the declaration of a member of the society. I belong to the society. So my life, my blood, everything I get belongs to the society. It explained that there is nothing more important than the society, and that he is ready to die for it, to suffer and die for it.
Mala vida, appartengo all'onorata.
Why did you decide to put this CD together?
I was thinking about how to let speak journalists about the very big social problem in the south of Italy, especially of Calabria. There are some villages where the young people, you know, 80% of them is unemployed, but they keep cool. I don't know why. Maybe it's in their culture to keep cool, because there were no time where in Calabria things were normal or correct. It was a land used to suffer, and the result is that every politician who puts his hands in Calabria, it's because of money. So politicians earn very much money from the south of Italy. It is a denunciation. The thing of the identity is every Calabrian tries to change their own pronunciation when they are abroad. They don't want to show they are Calabrians. They are ashamed of it. They are ashamed of it because they don't know their history. The history has been cancelled. They know, or they think, I'm Calabrian, what a shame. And this is very, very bad. This is anti-historical. So we have to correct the history, telling the people. And I get a message for the Italian-American organizations. They get the chance to learn a lesson of history. We want just this. We don't want, say, the mafia is good. Everybody in Calabria is against the mafia. Everybody I met in Calabria hate to speak about the mafia because it's like they speak about their self, about their life.
So you're saying this music celebrates Calabrian history and the Calabrian people, but it does not celebrate the mafia.
This is right. This is right.
Francesco Sabano is an Italian journalist. He's compiled a CD of Calabrian mafia music called La Musica della Mafia, Il Canto della Malavita. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
The problem with white people is we don't allow ourselves to feel things. Soul, there's no patent on soul, you know? And so she opened up and bled for us and made us believe that it's okay, you know, to be free.
Coming up, the life and music of Janis Joplin. Also, how do you spell the history of women through popular music? R-E-S-P-E-C-T would be one way. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Janis Joplin grew up in Port Arthur, Texas. It was a tiny conservative town where she never really felt at home. But the rock and roll world may owe Port Arthur a thank you. When Joplin was a teenager, she left Texas for San Francisco. She made a name for herself there as the first woman rocker with Big Brother and the Holding Company. Amy McCormick and Andra Mitrovich, think of Janis Joplin as a close friend. Together they've spent years touring the country in the two-woman play Love, Janis. Amy McCormick interprets actual letters Joplin wrote, and Andra Mitrovich plays the singer with guitarist John Nichols. Mitrovich told Steve Paulson that what really amazed people about Joplin wasn't her voice and the way she borrowed from the blues. It was the color of her skin.
You know, when she went overseas to like Germany and London and all those places, you have people saying, this is wild. You know, there's a white woman and she's singing the blues like a black lady, you know, like a black person. I mean, the soulfulness of her voice, you know, and it wasn't really about how she sounded. It was how she was feeling, and she let it go. You know, she opened up her soul a lot, which isn't easy. She even says it, you know, Amy says it in the play. The problem with white people is we don't allow ourselves to feel things. That's, you know, soul. There's no patent on soul, you know. And so she opened up and bled for us and made us believe that it's okay, you know, to be free and to sing how you're feeling.
Now, it's worth pointing out that Janis Joplin is from Port Arthur, Texas, which is a pretty small place. And she had a hard time there, which partly explains why she became the person she did. But why did she feel the need to rebel against Port Arthur?
Well, I think everybody, you know, I think that when you live in a small town and you're an artist or you're a creative person, you're labeled a freak.
And there's something, particularly about Texas where people don't see outside of Texas. It is its own country in a way.
At that time, rock and roll was considered a man's industry. What was Janis Joplin up against?
Oh, well...
Well, can
speaking
you think
as
of any
a woman,
other...
I mean, it's a man's world, baby, and it always will be. Seriously, I mean, you know, back then, women were supposed to be barefoot, pregnant, and, you know, and be married, and she wasn't. So when she was doing her music, it was a struggle. You know, you got cats out there playing guitar and drumming, and, you know, they've got their own idea of how music should sound. And all of a sudden, here's this woman from Texas who was not shy about saying anything.
And, yeah, let's face it, men have never known how to deal with women's emotions.
Absolutely. And let me tell you, she would go from the lowest of lows to the highest of highs in a split second.
You know,
and back down again. So as far as dealing with, you know, being in a man's world, she surrounded herself with men. You know, familiarity breeds contempt. I mean, she was still trying to find her place and failing at it. You know, I mean, not really. She was finding her place, but she wasn't realizing it until the very end that she had found her place, which is really quite amazing. I think that happens to a lot of people. You know, when death is knocking at your door and you haven't recognized the knock, when you finally do, it happens. It's very strange. All of her rough edges were definitely rounded at the end. I think she was figuring it out and realizing what was most important, and that was love, you know? Hmm.
Andrea, you do one of her songs in your show, Me and Bobby McGee, written by Kris Kristofferson.
Absolutely.
Could you do that for us?
Oh, I would love to. I never get tired of... singing these songs. It's funny, people ask me, they're like, so, are you sick of doing Love, Janis yet? I mean, I've been doing it for 5 years. I'm like, nope. It's the gospel, baby.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge, was waiting for a train, and I was feeling near as faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed the diesel down just before it rained, wrote a song all the way to New Orleans. Well, I pulled my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana, and I was playing soft while Bobby sang the blues loud. Windshield wipers slapping time, I was holding Bobby's hand in mine, and we sang every song that driver knew. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing ain't worth nothing, honey, if it ain't free. Yeah, and feeling good was easy, Lord, when we sang the blues. Feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me and my Bobby again. From the Kent
Kentucky coal mines to the California sun. Yeah, Bobby shared the secrets of my soul. Through all kinds of weather and everything that we've done, so Bobby, baby, kept me from this cold world. Now one day up near Selena's lawn, I let him slip away. Well, he's looking for that home, and I'll be fine. 'Cause I would trade all of my tomorrows for one single yesterday to be holding Bobby's body next to mine. Freedom's just another word. Oh, nothing left to lose. Nothing. Honey, nothing, honey, if it ain't free. Let him. Yeah, feeling gone was easy on your heart when we sang the blue. Feeling good was good enough for me. Good enough for me, hell of a baby. La da da, la da da, yeah. La da da. La da 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 da. Bobby McGee, yeah.
And I think what you're saying sheds a lot of light on what happened to Janis Joplin. I mean, why she flamed out at the end. I mean, you're really, mm-hmm. you're suggesting that it was just too much to put it all out there. That, I mean, I don't want to make excuses for her, but there are reasons why she ended up killing herself with drugs.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, being creative and being an artist, I think, is a really difficult role, you know? I mean, because you're always trying to be truthful and honest. And sometimes the powers that be that are outside cheering you on, sometimes they don't, pardon me.
Oh, boy.
Sometimes they don't want you to be better. You know, they want you to be what you put in that can, you know, what you put on that record. They want to hear that all the time. They don't want. Sometimes I don't think they want you to grow. And if you do, you have to be extremely better than what you are. You can't just, you know, go along with your life and decide, oh, I think I'm going to sing opera today. You know, I mean, I've been singing blues all my life, but I, you know, this interests me over here. People are going to ridicule you and go, what the hell are you doing? And I think that's what's really difficult for artists and creative people. And that's what was difficult for her. You know, she wanted to go out there and she wanted to do something new. And the second that she did it, they didn't understand it. And they told her that she sucked, you know. And she even makes a mention in the end. She's like, I'm not getting up here and singing Down on Me when I'm 80 years old. And, you know, unfortunately, she's not up here doing Down on Me because she's, you know, didn't make it to 80. But that was her journey. I think she taught us a lot. I really do. It is. I don't even know where my thoughts just went. I get so emotional sometimes because I just feel like, you know, for me, my life is, it's pretty linear to hers, only I didn't die in the end. I mean, I was one of the lucky ones. I was really one of the lucky ones. I'm not saying my life was stellar and that I didn't touch drugs and I didn't drink, you know, but I made it through, and probably because of her. Most likely.
There's a letter that she wrote right near the end of her life that I know is part of your performance. Amy, could you give us your rendition of that?
January 1970. Dear family, I managed to pass my 27th birthday without really feeling it. Ah, such a funny game. When you're nobody and poor, you don't care. You can just drift. But when you get a little position and a little money, you start really hustling to get more. And then when you're numero uno, you have to really break ass so nobody catches you. Catches you. Man, 2 years ago, I didn't even want to be it. No, that's not true. I've been looking around, and I noticed something. After you reach a certain level of talent, and quite a few have that talent, the deciding factor is ambition. Or as I see it, how much you really need. Need to be loved, and need to be proud of yourself. I guess that's what ambition is. It's not all a depraved quest for position, Mike, or money. Maybe it's for love. Lots of love. Ha! Oh, Linda Waldron and her 2-year-old daughter stayed with me for a week. First time I'd spent that much time around a young kid, it nearly drove me crazy. I sure am glad I can sing. I'd make a lousy wife and mother. Well, I wouldn't be too bad, actually. My piano teacher just arrived. I've got to go. All my love. And thank you for calling.
It's heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking. And she was a smart woman, you know. And I think but by 1970, her realization of what she was doing, you know, and what ambition was, her need for love, that's deep.
Amy McCormick and Andra Mitrovich star in the two-woman play Love, Janice. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Janis Joplin may have pushed the envelope for women in rock, but Dorothy Marsick thinks she didn't go far enough. Just look at her song, Piece of My Heart, not exactly a feminist anthem. Marsick studied the evolving role of women in 20th century America from a unique angle. Top 40 song lyrics. Her book is called Respect, Women and Popular Music. Now, Marsick says popular music in the early 1900s paints a picture of women as helplessly dependent on men.
Fanny Bryce, Ruth Etting, who was extremely popular, some people might still remember her, and Helen Kane, who was one of the top singers of the day. People don't remember her now, but she was so well-liked back then that she became the role model for the 1930s character Betty Boop.
I want to be loved by you, just you, nobody else but you. I want to be loved by you.
You even wrote that she sued when Betty Boop was created because she said, hey, guys, you've just taken me.
Yes, and if you listen back to Helen Kane's song of I Want to Be Loved by You, you will think that that is Betty Boop singing because the style is exactly the same. And in fact, in the first cartoons, the first few years that Betty Boop was having cartoons made about her. The beginning cartoon had a picture of Helen Kane in her name. After the suit, they quit doing that and they actually took them off of the earlier ones. So that was very clear that they were patterning it after Helen Kane.
I want to be loved by you.
What about the wartime? Did that change people? Perception of women? Did it change possibilities for women singers as it did for factory workers, for instance?
It did, because as we know, most men were gone to war and women took over the factories, the office. They started to feel some power. You had, of course, a lot of songs about the war, but there were some songs about strength. My favorite is Dinah Shore's 1942 song, Blues in the Night, where she says, my mama done told me when I was in pigtails, my mama done told me, hon, a man's gonna sweet talk and give you the glad eye, but when that sweet talking's done, a man is a two-face and he'll leave you to sing the blues in the night.
And that leads, of course, directly to the 1950s when Mamie Eisenhower was the first lady and
right, and you've got a lot of gold digger songs. Because if you think about it logically, an intelligent woman, if she has to depend on a man for her living, she better find a rich one. So you had songs like Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend, Big Spender, and then I Enjoy Being a Girl, Doris Day's Que Sera Sera, which to me is the ultimate song in what we in my profession call external locus of control, which means I'm never in charge of myself. I always have to ask someone else, get them to make decisions for me, because she's asking first her mother, then her teacher and her lover, what will I be? What will I do?
So when the 50s ended and we moved into the 60s, was there an immediate turn in the lyrics?
No, there was an overlap. It took until about 63, 64 for the Songs of Anger to come up, and that was just about the time when the women's movement was starting. Betty Friedan's book came out in 63, and I think of music as a lagging indicator. It's just slightly behind what's happening because music is illustrating the values that are going on, and so it's just a little behind what those values are. So the women's movement was starting around 60. Betty Friedan's book came out in 63. There was all these consciousness-raising groups, and You Don't Own Me, which to me signifies the beginning of these songs, came out in 1964. So it was a song pushing back, you don't own me, I'm not just one of your many toys. It was very different from I Will Follow Him and Johnny Get Angry, I Want a Caveman, I Want a Brave Man. And then a few years later, 1968, Nancy Sinatra's number one song, These Boots Are Made for Walking, which was really, hey, guy, I'm in charge here, I'm not going to put up with this anymore.
These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you.
You know, the other thing, the other woman singer from the late 60s, early 70s that you really can't avoid talking about has to be Aretha Franklin.
Oh, Aretha, yes. And there's another example. We owe a lot to African American women in this movement towards empowerment, because it was the first songs that were about pushing back came from black blues singers. And it was Dinah Shore who owed a lot to these early black blues singers, Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith and so on. And then Leslie Gore comes and says, you don't own me. But I think it still owes a lot to these black women singers. And then Aretha singing R-E-S-P-E-C-T, which set a new tone for women's independence.
When we're talking about Aretha Franklin, I mean, respect, R-E-S-P-E-C-T was a big hit. What are the lyrics to it?
Well, interesting. That song was written by Otis Redding. He recorded it in the late 50s or early 60s, and it never got to the top 40. I think it got to number 72. Aretha took it with the exact same lyrics, and the meaning is very different. Now, most people don't know the lyrics. They know the chorus. But the lyrics of the verses are, I come home from work every day and I give you all my money and I just want my just desserts. I want some R-E-S-P-E-C-T. And it's so different when a man says that from when a woman says it. Because when a man says it, you say, okay, he's the breadwinner. He comes home and he wants her just to, you know, give him whatever. But when a woman's singing it, it has the implication that he's laying around all day and she's working and bringing home the money. And I always found that song ironic in a sense that it is about a woman taking care of a man and wanting some respect. So I think, now, where's the equality in that one? But the point is that people don't listen to the verse. They listen to the lyrics of the chorus, which is R-E-S-P-E-C-T, find out what it means to me. R-E-S-P-E-C-T, take care, TCB, which nobody's ever been able to figure out that I know what that is. Just give me some respect.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T, find out what it means to me. R-E-S-P-E-C-T, take care of TCB.
After the 60s, women felt empowered, but did it last? Did we move into the 70s and 80s feeling as though women had found their spot?
Well, to some extent. I mean, we went through a period in the 70s and early 80s of cynicism. And I think that comes from the anger that pulled away the veils of denial. This whole codependent, needy era that we were in for so long was also characterized by not really seeing the truth, being in denial. Oh, he's going to love me, no, and all my problems are going to be solved. It's the white knight coming to save us. And anger has a way of stripping away that. And we started to see that there is no Prince Charming who's going to save us from ourselves. And what happened is then a whole series of songs that were very cynical. Janis Ian's at 17, I learned that love was meant for beauty queens. Tina Turner's What's Love Got to Do with It. Madonna's Material Girl, I Don't Want Love, I Want Cold Hard Cash. And so we had to go through that cynical period. But then out of that, by the late 80s, did come that inner strength. By the 90s, there's this buildup of the inner strength of women, and that actually was the largest category in the 90s. But at the same time, there were these really filthy songs about women singing about sex and sexual things. I do think that one can only go so far. I mean, if you look at some of the recent videos, like Christina Aguilera's new video out, I mean, how much further can you go? And because I'm an internal optimist, is going to win out, that women are not going to have to resort to using their sex to get power, because we're going to have it from our inner strength.
Let's go back just a little bit. The 80s have to be a kind of a high point, don't you think? I mean, songs like Cyndi Lauper's Girls Just Want to Have Fun.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
You still hear it played today.
You do. And her message, whether it was back in the 80s or today, is one of strength and women finding some new ground. That Girls Just Want to Have Fun, it's not only just a fun song, but the message was, we don't want those double standards anymore. It's time for us to be equal.
Dorothy Marsick is the author of Respect, Women and Popular Music. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Mary Lou Finnegan, with engineering help from Marv Nunn. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Society Music. Number 12-1A.
PRI, Public Radio International.